Who's the real Barack Obama? That's the question Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter David Marinus wanted to answer. So he traveled around the world, from remote villages of Kenya to small towns of Kansas, from Indonesia to Hawaii, to see the places where Obama and his family once lived, to talk with people who've known him. Marinus tells Steve Paulson that he had to puncture some of the myths about Obama, including those the president himself has perpetuated.
There are many mythologies built up around Barack Obama. One is that he's some kind of a secret Muslim, and it was by going to Kenya that I sort of saw the real story, which is that his grandfather, Hussein Onyango, did convert to Islam after World War I, but that, in fact, at every step along the way in the rise of the Obamas in Kenya, it was evangelical Christian missionaries from the West who were most influential. You know, they're the ones that came out to Western Kenya as Seventh-day Adventists and taught the grandfather English and westernized him. Then the president's father, Barack Obama Sr., was also educated by missionaries and essentially mentored by a particularly fascinating American woman named Betty Mooney. She's the reason he ended up in Hawaii, in the United States, the reason Barack Obama exists.
We should talk some about Barack Obama's father, Obama Sr.
Yes.
You say that Barack, the son, was actually very lucky that he spent so little time with his father when he was a small boy.
It's not something I feel terribly comfortable saying about anybody else. I mean, it's, you know, that's for him to say. But from an outsider's perspective, doing all the research, I just think that the father was a brilliant man, very frustrated man, who was also an alcoholic, and beyond that was physically abusive.
To his wives.
I don't know for certain that he was abusive to Stanley Ann Dunham, Barack Obama's mother, because they were only together for a very brief amount of time and she's no longer living. But his next wife, his third wife, who was also an American, Ruth Baker Indesanjo, I spent a long afternoon with her as she told me one horrific story after another about the physical abuse that she endured at his hands several times when she was afraid for her life. And so that certainly would have been a difficult situation for a young boy to have to deal with. And even though his book is called Dreams from My Father, you know, I think that in truth, he's better off not knowing his dad.
I want to play a clip from the very end of that book, Obama reading the audio book. And this is after he's gone to Africa to meet his extended family, and he's reflecting on his father.
With the degree, the ascot, the American wife, the car, the words, the figures, the wallet, the proper proportion of tonic to gin, the polish, the panache, the entire thing seamless and natural, what could stand in his way? He had almost succeeded in a way his own father could never have hoped for. And then, after seeming to travel so far, to discover that he had not escaped after all, to discover that he remained trapped on his father's island, with its fissures of anger and doubt and defeat, the emotion still visible beneath the surface, hot and molten and alive, like a wicked, yawning mouth, and his mother gone, gone away. I dropped to the ground and swept my hand across the smooth yellow tile. "Oh, father," I cried, "there was no shame in your confusion. There was only shame in the silence fear had produced. It was the silence that betrayed us."
That silence being all that was unsaid between various members of the Obama family?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's very evocative and beautifully written, and yet it's not the story as I know it. I don't think that there was much silence about Barack Obama Sr.
It's interesting how you describe that book, Dreams from My Father, and of course that's how many of us first really learned
yes.
about the story of Barack Obama. You say this properly falls in the category of literature and memoir, not history and autobiography. We should not read that as factually accurate. For one thing, as has been widely reported, he creates composite characters instead of actual people, which he himself has acknowledged.
Yes, he does that in his introduction.
What do you see as some of the most important ways that Obama strayed from the real story?
You know, I let him read the introduction to my book before I interviewed him. You know, in the Oval Office, after a little talk about the Packers and Bears to start with.
You being a Packer fan,
and
he being a Bears fan.
Yes. He said, "David, you know, I read your introduction. It's very interesting, but you call my book fiction." I hadn't. I called it literature. I was complimenting him in a way. But there is a vast difference between memoir and factual biography. What I found was You know, some of the stories in his book were family mythologies passed along. You know, his parents or grandparents had told him stories, and they were the family story. When you think about it, any of us have certain things that we've been told by our parents and grandparents that if a biographer were to go back and check, might not be quite the story as it really was. In that sense, you know, he said that his Kenyan grandfather was imprisoned and tortured by the British. I could find, there are no documents saying it. I interviewed 6 people who knew the grandfather fairly well who said it didn't happen. Similarly, he said that his step-grandfather in Indonesia was killed as a martyr fighting the Dutch for independence. And in fact, he died falling off a stool in his living room, changing the drapes. A slightly different story.
I guess the question is whether anything very important
was altered. I don't think so. I don't really think so. I mean, I think that his book was an attempt to convey his internal struggle as he was searching for his identity. And the original title of the book and the first proposal which I got was Journeys in Black and White.
You mentioned that a huge subject of that book was Obama coming to terms with race. I mean,
yes,
with his peculiar upbringing, as he puts it, his father was black as pitch and his mother as white as milk. And I want to play another excerpt from his audiobook where he's reflecting back at the time when he's in college and what it meant to be black.
Since my first frightening discovery of Bleaching Creams in Life magazine, I'd become familiar with the lexicon of color consciousness within the black community. Good hair, bad hair, thick lips or thin. If you're light, you're all right. If you're black, get back. In college, the politics of black fashion and the questions of self-esteem that fashion signified had been a frequent, if delicate, topic of conversation for black students, especially among the women, who would smile bitterly at the sight of the militant brother who always seemed to be dating light-skinned girls. Mostly, I had kept quiet when these subjects were broached, but I noticed that such conversations rarely took place in large groups, and never in front of whites. Later, I would realize that the position of most black students in predominantly white colleges was already too tenuous, our identities too scrambled, to admit to ourselves that our black pride remained incomplete. To open up our psyches to general examination by those who had caused so much of the damage in the first place seemed ludicrous, for there seemed no reason to expect that whites would look at our private struggles as a mirror into their own souls, rather than yet more evidence of black pathology.
So the question of black identity was obviously hugely important to Obama's coming of age. I mean, sort of figuring out what his own identity was. Do you think he resolved those questions?
Well, we think about even from his birth, he on the one hand, was born with black skin, so he had to deal with race in America from the very beginning. On the other hand, he grew up with a white mother and white grandparents and not knowing his father, and so he had to learn African-American culture. I think that while, again, that part that we had him read is very evocative, it doesn't quite fit his own story as cleanly as one might think. You know, during that whole period, most of his girlfriends were white. At Occidental, for the first time, he was with classmates and peers who were black. But he was not particularly comfortable with many of those black students who came from Compton or inner cities or Philadelphia and so on. And he was more of an internationalist. His closest friends at Occidental were neither black nor white. They were Pakistanis. When he got to New York, none of the leaders of the Black Student Organization at Columbia remembered him, really. You know, while he was in New York, for many months, he carried a frayed copy of Ralph Ellison's Invisible Man around with him. And in some sense, he was Invisible Man. He was black-skinned, but neither culturally black nor white yet, and he was trying to find his home.
How far back can you trace Obama's presidential ambitions? When did he start talking to friends about this crazy idea that maybe someday he could become president?
Well, it's certainly not like Bill Clinton, the other president whose biography I've written. You know, with Clinton, he ran for every office as in high school until his principal came to him and said, "Billy, you can't run anymore. We're sick of you." You don't see that with Obama. In New York, one of his friends, Binu Mahmood, one of the Pakistanis, Binu recalled to me that one day Barack said, "Do you think that I could ever be president of the United States?" And what he was really asking is, do you think a black person could be president?
So how old was he then?
He was 22.
Of course, the question always with the people who become president is what drives them.
Right.
And, I mean, there's the sense that they're not like the rest of us. They are, You don't want to say freaks, but they're somehow different.
Yeah,
and
well,
so is it ego? I mean, for Obama, ego, is it wanting to change the world, to be a transformative figure in political history? What's your sense?
Well, you can never dismiss ego. I mean, that has to be there for any politician successfully. So I would say that his mother's conscience, the desire to change the world, is probably number one. Competitive will is number two. Ego goes along with that.
Washington Post editor David Marinus talking with Steve Paulson about his biography, Barack Obama, The Story.